listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 89. This minute opens with Shaw trying to process what's going on after encountering Wayland, and ends with Wayland saying, "Well, save me anyway." Shaw realizes Wayland has been on the ship the entire time. Wayland explains he only has a few days of life left in him, and he didn't want to waste them. I think it isn't beyond the realm of possibility that they are able to know how long someone has left to live, down to the precise day. It's just like knowing the due date of a baby, but the opposite. It was recently discovered that through DNA we can know the intended lifespan of an animal. Human beings are only supposed to live for 38 years. Of course, since about the invention of agriculture onwards, we have long surpassed that limit. So theoretically, whatever means by which Wayland was able to calculate his lifespan, presuming he is being literal and that is what we do on this show, it wouldn't be all that different. Reading telomeres and taking into account other biological factors, I believe you could conceivably get pretty accurate. And also, just look at the guy, he's got one foot in the grave. The notion of not even reaching 40 is crazy to me. I feel like I've only just reached adulthood in the past few years. I'm 28, so I guess I should prepare for retirement then. I know people mature at different speeds, but even in a primitive world where people were having babies in their early and mid-teens, 38 is young, or maybe such a world is simply too alien for me to really comprehend. It makes me wonder, in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you spend your entire life down the bottom somewhere, and all you care about is the next meal and escaping predators, the very concept of maturity is totally different. You are an adult if you can use a weapon, kill your prey, and you can sire children, ideally in that order. That was about the scope of it. Nowadays, the demands on us are far greater and more sophisticated. It's not enough to have basic survival skills or self-care skills. Instead, you must know how to manage finances, make long-term plans and commitments, navigate complex social, political, and bureaucratic systems, not to mention exercising responsibility and self-control in a world of excess. Our hunter-gatherer instincts no longer serve us in a world where everything is available immediately. I wouldn't say our lives are necessarily easier or harder than those of our early ancestors, it's just that the challenges we face are different. We are certainly more comfortable now, though. So tying that back in with Prometheus, I do have a point here. Maslow's hierarchy, for those who don't remember by heart, at the bottom we have physiological needs, then the need for safety, above that, love or belonging, and above that, esteem and self-actualization. However, Maslow later proposed a level above even that, transcendence. I quote him here. "Transcendence refers to the very highest and most inclusive or holistic levels of human consciousness, behaving and relating as ends rather than means to oneself, to significant others, to human beings in general, to other species, to nature, and the cosmos." Prometheus absolutely takes place in that top level. Or at least it begins and ends the film there. Which, fittingly enough, are the only times we see Wayland. To him, this has been the pursuit of the lofty and abstract goal of ascension. To everyone else, it has become a brutal struggle for survival. And here, in this very minute, these two worlds collide in jarring juxtaposition. Shaw is literally covered in blood, sweat, and tears. And she is kneeling before the man she, ostensibly, shed them for. He, on the other hand, is clean, dressed all in white, and has people tending to his every need, all except one, his need for transcendence. Wayland has amassed such a vast fortune, such security, accomplishment, and prestige, and yet he has lived so long that it is no longer enough. He now seeks something even greater than himself, quite literally in this sense. We know he has held onto this notion from at least the time of David's creation, perhaps his whole life. But transcendence can only become his main goal once he had elevated to his current status. Did ancient man also seek transcendence? This can certainly be said of humanity since the beginning of written history at least, when civilization as we know it emerged. But if you have been alive for only 20 to 25 years, already have a few children to look after, and you have to constantly search for food, battle the weather, the environment, predators, and disease, do you even have the mental resources to imagine something greater? And if so, what was their conception of it? As long as there have been humans, there have been gods. But to the ancient people, gods were the answer in and of themselves. In Prometheus, God owes us an answer. And that ties into what I was saying before about we live in a world where our hunter-gatherer instincts don't really serve us well because food and novelty and everything you can possibly imagine is immediately available. So we're having to learn discipline and abstinence and all those sorts of things and finding satisfaction on a level that is beyond those base physical requirements, tying it all back into Maslow's hierarchy. And I was watching a documentary about minimalism recently, and it wasn't that great. It was very slow. It was just like, get to the point, you can't watch things on double speed on Netflix, so maybe I'll check out the rest later. But I'm absolutely a minimalist, and I am quite interested in Buddhist philosophy and a lot of those sorts of things. So I feel like as society advances, we will go in that direction where happiness has to come from somewhere other than those base desires, because those are way too easy to satisfy. Sort of like the society we see in Star Trek, where the accumulation of wealth and possessions aren't really what people are interested in. Of course, if you're a Ferengi, that's very much your thing. But for the Federation, it seems to be about bettering yourself, prestige, you know, achieving something, becoming an officer, a doctor, whatever it is. And I think that's really relevant as an issue we face these days. I think that's why we are seeing a lot of anxiety and depression, and why things like meditation and fasting and NoFap November are suddenly becoming popular. It's that you can find happiness on a higher level. So maybe human beings are kind of getting towards that transcendence and trying to better themselves and trying to find satisfaction somewhere above those base needs on the hierarchy. I mean, of course, not everyone does that. There are definitely people who are just like, I like to eat, I like to have sex, I like to just, yeah, do all those things to excess. But I don't know, maybe that works for some people, I cannot say. It is ironic that Weyland's body is failing him. He is so frail he can barely walk. In a natural environment, he would be completely defenseless. His position and his safety are assured by money, power, and influence in ways that did not exist in the ancient world. Weyland lives an artificial life by artificial means. He has removed himself from the circle of life and the natural order as much as any human being can. And of course, he's the antagonist. Another irony here is that transcendence seems to be the natural end goal of a sufficiently advanced person living in a sufficiently advanced society. And yet so often this motivation is given to the villain. It is unnatural, it is selfish to seek more, to extend your life, at least according to fiction. This is why debates about extending human longevity are so controversial. But how can it be inherently good or evil? It is not inherently good nor evil to be alive. It is what one does with that life that matters. I personally would love to live as long as I can, and I don't intend on conquering the world. I just want to continue to be a good and hopefully productive member of society, assuming in this scenario I don't have chronic fatigue syndrome. I would use that time to enrich other people's lives, to live life to its fullest. But we seldom, if ever, see a character like that in fiction. There's never some well-meaning character seeking immortality so they can continue to be a part of the lives of their children and grandchildren. No one ever seeks more time because they want to oversee some impossibly long-term project like reversing climate change or the conservation of an endangered habitat or species. No, it's always unlimited power. Speaking of Star Wars, and it keeps slipping into the show, yes, I know, there is a prime example. Jedi do not seek to extend their life by unnatural means, but the Sith do. Extended lore indicates that this is because there is no afterlife for Sith as there is for the Jedi, but you get what I mean. I think maybe the only example counter to this is Santa Claus. And that's about it. And even then, I feel like Santa stories do tend to skew towards that thing of you're chosen for this duty and there is a tragedy to it, it's a burden. So it's the same thing with, you know, the whole vampire thing of, oh no, I have lived for centuries, it's so tragic. Yeah, shut up. I believe this notion is as common as anti-intellectualism in American media, especially in the 20th century. Being smart was uncool, the nerd archetype was very much a thing, the protagonist would make fun of a character for actually knowing something. In American film and television, intelligence was, and still is partially, associated with elitism and arrogance. Thankfully, Tony Stark has now made it cool, so problem solved, I guess. It is interesting to me to notice these cultural notions that permeate all media. They're so subtle, maybe even the writers don't stop to question it. But they should. Why doesn't the hero ever want to live longer? Why is the smart guy always an asshole or a nerd or both? Why does the android always want to be human? It's only by interrogating the status quo that true creativity can begin, and where we can tell new stories. A lot of people criticize this plot twist. Why did Wayland have to be kept a secret? What was the point in hiding? And honestly, I don't know what this reveal accomplishes either. He funded this expedition, he didn't have to mention any ulterior motives, he could have been here this whole time and then Shaw could walk in on him getting suited up, and this scene plays out exactly the same. She's still like, oh, what are you doing? I didn't expect you to go out there, what are you going out there for? You know, it's still the exact same plot beat. I don't know if it's because I've seen this movie so many times, but I honestly don't have a problem with Wayland's makeup at all. It's definitely much better than the old people on Star Trek. I mean, Noonien Sung, oof, more like brown paper bag Yoda. David is the one to break the news to Shaw that the engineers are still alive, one of them at least. He is visibly enthused about this. And this is the first time we've seen Wayland and David interacting on screen. David is completely subservient, showing not even a hint of insubordination. He's been playing this role for decades now. If anything, he seems even more well-behaved than when he is serving the other humans. He's much more condescending and snarky, usually. Perhaps his present excitement is the possibility that Wayland is not long for this world. He probably never held any illusion that Wayland would ascend in any way. More than likely, he has imagined a scenario where the engineers find David far more worthy of their favor. It's ironic, really. Wayland and David share something of the same fate, and yet neither expects it to happen to themselves. And now we'll read this scene from the Paradise script, pages 84 to 88. Interior, Magellan, hallway, day. Shaw staggers back into the hallway, running God knows where as she moves through the hallways of the ship. She just survived the ordeal of her life, can barely keep her feet under her, finally collapses. And we're in her POV at ground level, in and out of focus. And God, finally someone is coming as eight pairs of boots come around the corner and stop. Shaw can only whisper, on the verge of consciousness, please, help. But the boots don't move towards her. Instead, they part like the Red Sea, making way for a wheelchair rolling towards Shaw. She uses the last of her strength to pick up her head, moving up the withered legs to see the face of its occupant, Arthur Wayland. Not the virile specimen David spoke to, but the pale, wrinkled old man we met in the orientation video. Shaw blinks, can't believe her eyes. She must be hallucinating. But she manages to croak out, What are you doing here? But before he can answer her, Shaw drops to the ground, eyes fluttering, and now a gruff voice, presumably belonging to one of the booted men. The robot said she was infected. A rifle enters frame, pointed at head. This is it. But Wayland's wrinkled hand grabs the end of the gun, pushes it away. I don't care what he said. She's with me. And as Shaw's eyes finally close, we smash cut to Interior Magellan Infirmary, day. Shaw sits bolt upright, hands instinctively to her stomach. Wayland, it's all right, dear. Shaw blinks, orients herself. She's back in the infirmary, dressed in a tank and pants. It's dark in here, noirish, not to mention the occasional vibrations from the seismic activity of the planet. More importantly, however, Wayland sits beside her in a wheelchair, smiles. It appears you've broken my med pod. David stands impassively towards the back of the infirmary. Vickers is here as well. She barks at Shaw. What the hell were you doing in my room? Wayland holds up his hand. This woman has been through a horrible ordeal, Miss Vickers. Please leave us. Vickers fumes, clearly no longer in charge, nods to David. And he gets to stay? He is a machine. You shouldn't be any more threatened by him than you are a toaster, Meredith. David blinks, registering his place in Wayland's eyes. I mean, yeah, this can't be the first time. Vickers shakes her head, walks to the door. I'll be outside if you need me. And with that, Vickers exits. Shaw's head is spinning, still trying to catch up as she takes in Wayland. The med pod is yours? Men my age tend to have issues waking from 2-year naps, so I came prepared. And it finally comes together. You've been asleep, here on this ship, all this time. Why? Because I only have a few days of life left in me, dear. And I certainly wasn't going to waste them until I was certain you could deliver what you promised. Okay, that is fair enough. That is a logical reason that he didn't know how long this expedition was going to take. And very likely he could have died before they found what they needed. It could take years. So this is a case where it's actually logical in terms of real world logistics. But in terms of script writing, it's just like, okay, you're framing this as a reveal. Why? If they had basically just said from the beginning, yeah, Wayland's here, but he's in cryo because who knows how long this will take. Freaking do that. That makes sense. And you're not framing it as this illogical plot twist that isn't even a twist. So, back to Wayland. I'll be honest, when you first told me about giants inviting us to the stars, I thought you were under the influence of some very excellent drugs. Leans forward, smiles. But then you made me a believer, Shaw. You convinced me that if these things made us, maybe they could save us. Well, save me, actually. Save you? From what? On Wayland, the moment of truth, finally. Why? Death, of course. Christ, so there it is. Wayland is just Ponce de Leon, looking for the Fountain of Youth. Shaw is shocked. Ah, you think I'm mad. Well, let's see how you feel about it when you're 180 years old, dear. Shaw shakes her head at the hubris of it all, turns to David, exasperated. Haven't you told him what we found? Haven't you told him they're all gone? But they're not all gone, Dr. Shaw. A beat, another. Because it takes Shaw a moment to process what he just said. What? One of them is still alive. We're on our way to wake him up now. On Shaw, let us fully understand the impact of this moment for her. This information literally changes everything. But still, no, you can't. They were making something here, something terrible. Wayland, dismissive. They invited us here. Why would they want to hurt us? Yes, we knocked over some of their test tubes and things got out of hand, but... Out of hand? Do you have any idea what's happening here? We need to leave now. Silence. The mercs all look at each other. No one has ever spoken to Arthur Wayland in this way, ever. And after a moment he responds, calm as he can be. No, dear. I don't have any idea what's happening here, which is why I'm going to talk to the one being in the universe that can tell me. This ship isn't going anywhere. So, you can stay on it, or you can come with us. Shaw's confused, wasn't expecting an invite. Wayland rolls forward, looking her right in the eyes. Don't you want to talk to them? Don't you want to understand who they are? why they made us. You've come all this way. You've lost the man you loved. Don't you deserve an explanation? Unsure, really feeling the emotion of that for the first time. Waylon sees he's getting through, softly. You were the one who convinced me they invited us here for a reason. Is it really possible for you to leave here without knowing what it was? Then, almost a dare, or have you lost your faith, Dr. Shaw? Unsure, she shakes her head, but as much as she hates him for it, Waylon is absolutely right. She looks at him now. If her expression has subtitles, they would simply read, "Fuck you." So I feel this scene is far more nuanced in that we see a more complex Waylon. I feel Waylon, I mean, this is part of his appeal, that Waylon is an unapologetic, unabashed asshole in the films, that he has this God complex and he has very little regard for other people. Whereas here I feel he's playing this kindly old man persona. And that's much more interesting to me because it leaves you in this state of uncertainty and you don't know why he wants Shaw there. So I think it is an improvement. And I know the usual debate is, oh, the Engineer script is so much better than Prometheus. But here I would say this is actually where Paradise is getting it right, where the film doesn't. So, it's an interesting change. Well, I suppose the other example is, you know, including young Waylon, so that the makeup is justified. Alright, that about covers it. This is Coulson signing off. You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVIAN. There's also a link to the Patreon through that website. And you can also find me on Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. I would like to give a thanks to my Patreon supporters, Mark Boda and Tariq. So if you would like to become a Patreon pal, a Patreon supporter, and get some exclusive content, sign on up today.